don't smoke, eat less, or certainly don't become obese, do some exercise, eat the right foods and get sleep and don't stress, have some friends around. That gives you 14 years of extra life compared to someone who doesn't do those things.
Welcome to Longevity by Design, a podcast designed to give individuals access to the leading scientific information in the field of longevity. The ability to add years to your life and life to your years needs no opinion. Join us as we ask science to take the wheel. In each episode, Dr. Gil Blander joins a co-host and an industry expert in the field of longevity, shining a light and getting the answers to the key question, how can we live a longer, healthier life?
Hello, I'm Ashley Reaver, and I'm joined by Dr. Gil Blander. Welcome to Longevity by Design, how to live a longer, healthier life. We're produced by Inside Tracker, your science-based guide to optimizing your body from the inside out. Our guest today is Dr. David Sinclair. David Sinclair is a professor in the Department of Genetics and co-director of the Paul F. Glenn Center for Biology of Aging at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Sinclair is the co-founder of several biotechnology companies and is on the board of several others. He's also a co-founder and co-chief editor of the journal Aging. He's an investor on 35 patents, an inventor, excuse me, and has received more than 35 awards and honors. In 2014, he was named on Time Magazine's list of 100 most influential people in the world and was listed as Time's top 50 in healthcare in 2018. Not that you needed that introduction, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Ashley.
So, David, it's a big pleasure for me to have you with us. And I just want to give the audience some background about how we know each other. So David and myself done the postdoctoral fellowship at the same lab, at the Lenny Guerrante lab. And actually, I met David the first time when a friend of mine that done his postdoc at David lab, his name is Chaim Cohen, invited me to come to his lab. And that was when I joined actually the lab of Lenny. And I remember that David told me, hey, Gil, you should come to me and be my postdoc. And I said, come on, I want to go to the best lab in the world, the lab of Lenny. And I think that it was great to do the postdoc there, but I'm sure that it wasn't a big mistake to go and join David and do the postdoc there. I'm sure that all of you know that David done a great job and made a lot of progress in the aging research field. So it was a pleasure to know David then. It was 2001. And since then, we done a lot of work together. We published a paper together. And when I came with the idea of Inside Tracker, I think that was 2008 or 2009, David came to me and said, hey, Gil, that was actually my idea as well, but because you are starting it, I will join you. So I really appreciate that David believe of a partnership instead of a competition. So it was a great journey with David. And David, welcome to our podcast. And Ashley, please start.
Awesome. Well, David, can you start kind of with walking us through your career and how you ended up with an interest in aging and then focusing on aging in your career as well?
Sure. Yeah, first of all, Gil, it's been great knowing you too as a colleague and a friend over all these years. Chaim did okay. He's now a successful guy. Just had a Nature paper on SIRT6 extending lifespan in mice just last week, I think. So my career is pretty simple. Since I was 4, I wanted to do something important. Was shocked that all of us conscious beings will die mostly a painful and slow death, and thought that was something to try to work on. To me, that seems obvious. Been doing that my whole life. Got a PhD in Australia in genetics. Most people don't know I spent a year in Wales, in Cardiff, working in a cold room, and that turned me off biochemistry for my whole life. So I thought genetics would be a better approach. So I studied yeast cells because they smell good and you can work in a warm room, which is also great. And so I started to work with, I got a PhD in yeast genetics. Actually, I'll give you a bit of detail because often I don't get a chance. I worked on a disease called maple syrup urine disease, and that's because people's urine smells like maple syrup. And I suppose it's not good for them, but I can imagine worse things. We cloned the genes. I kid. It's a terrible disease. We cloned the genes responsible in yeast and figured out some other stuff. But I was mostly interested in aging still. And so when Lenny Guerrante came to visit Australia, I had dinner with him and was excited that he was working on yeast aging. And so I decided to go to his lab. And long story short, after a lot of pain and trials and errors and luck, I ended up in his lab with a fellowship in 1995 and spent 4 years there, and then got a job at Harvard Medical School. And that was in 1999. I'm that old. So that was 20 something years ago. I've been there ever since. And I run a center for aging and a lab of around 20 people. And we try to focus on the big questions about aging and health and wellness, and then try to make things useful for society, not just publish and move on. And so you've probably seen in my career, we don't just rest on our publications. We actually do more than that. And some of my trainees have gone on to become very successful venture capitalists or in industry as well as in academia. And yeah, it's been a joy working with InsideTracker from the beginning. I was the first board member, one of the first investors, and I could see the future, and it's actually arrived. So it's super exciting to be here.
So thank you so much for the warm words, David. Can we go a bit back and ask you about when did you know that you want to be a scientist and what made you to become a scientist?
Well, I'm not very good at basketball or
me neither.
So this is pretty much the only thing I'm really good at. I'm very curious. I like pulling things apart. I like discovering things. I've got what I'm calling in my next book, the FU gene. In my family, we just don't listen to what anyone says. And if anyone has an opinion, we take the opposite stance. So that works in science. That's what you want. And so I went into science. I was going to be a doctor, but realized that I didn't, when I was a teenager, I didn't like people that much. And I didn't want to interact with them every day. So I went to the bench instead and liked mucking around with yeast cells.
They definitely don't smell as good as yeast. So I get you on that. Okay. So David, you released or published a very successful book, Lifespan, which all of us at InsideTracker were fortunate enough to get as a gift. What inspired you kind of to write that book?
Well, a couple of things. The main thing was that I was asked the same questions over and over again. And I thought, why don't I just write a book that answers all those questions that people want to know? But I wasn't going to write a book until my career was towards the end. But an agent called me in 2005 and said, hey, I'll help you write a book. I'll help you with this and that. It won't be much work. Well, so I agreed. What was it? It was more than a decade later. I was still working on it. So it was a lot of work. And that was also hard. The book got written. The financial crisis happened. My publisher and editor went out of business. And for a while there, it looked like the book would never get published. So I updated it. And it came out in 2019, at the end of 2019, and went to be a bestseller. So super fortunate. But if there's one lesson here, it's never give up. If you start something, just keep pushing and pushing, and you'll eventually get there.
David, I remember one day that we met in, I think that it was in a restaurant in Harvard Square, and you showed me a few of the artifacts that you draw in the book, and you asked me, do you understand it? Don't you understand? It was really exciting to see all the drawing that you made, and I was fortunate enough to see the process of writing the book, and I can say that it took you a long time to do it, but it's one of the best books that I read, so congrats for that. If it's okay with you, I would like to move a bit more to a basic science. And if you can explain to our audience why intermittent fasting make at least model organism and hopefully human live longer. Can you give us a basic explanation for that?
Sure. Well, I'd be totally shocked if intermittent fasting didn't help people live longer, certainly healthier. So this has been known for thousands of years. We're not that smart. But what we have figured out, we think, is that it works because it turns on the body's defenses against disease and aging. And Gil and I have worked on some of these genes called sirtuins, and there are other ones. There's one called AMPK that controls energy. mTOR controls defenses in response to amino acid levels. And so what you do when you fast is you turn on these defenses, and if you sit around and become too obese and you eat constantly, these defenses won't actually be activated. And that's the reason I think they primarily work. It's not that blood flows better or just that insulin sensitivity changes. You really are turning on every cell's defenses against DNA damage, against toxins, everything that causes diseases. It seems that these defenses have a way to slow down the negative effects.
Okay. So, David, you mentioned Chaim Cohen and CIR-T6, and we interviewed already a few very good scientists for this podcast, and all of them say CIR-T6 is the new hot subject in longevity. So can you give our audience a bit of your view of CIR-T6? Why is it so important?
Right. Well, so just update on sirtuins. They were discovered first in yeast, and then are named after the gene SIR2, silent inflammation regulator number 2. And inflammation is the important part, because inflammation, I believe, the loss of inflammation is the problem during aging, and that's both genetic and epigenetic inflammation. And CIR-T6 is one of 7 sirtuins that protects the cell, and there are 3 of them that protect things that go on in the nucleus to do with the DNA and the epigenome. And CIR-T6 and CIR-T1 seem to be the most important for that. They repair DNA and they control gene expression, as well as other things like retrotransposons, these hitchhikers in our genome. But CIR-T6 seems to be the most potent slash important, because when you turn it on or give extra copies in mice, you get a robust lifespan extension. CIR-T1 hasn't been as successful. Shin Imai at WashU has shown that CIR-T1 in the brain can extend lifespan, but the transgenic didn't seem to extend lifespan, and for reasons that we think have to do with the pituitary. But long story short, the CIR-T6 is exciting. We're working on molecules that activate CIR-T6. I have a startup company with John Danu and Lenny Garenti working on that. And so it's super exciting. I know Chaim has a similar company. And if we could activate CIR-T6, we could improve metabolism, downregulate hyperinflammation, and even treat cancer, we think.
Excellent. So the follow-up question is, all the CIR2 family are NAD-dependent death settlers. So I'm sure that our audience would love to understand what is NAD, and also learn about the small molecules that have been floating around, that have been discussed to improve longevity, and are an NMN. So can you discuss that, please?
Yeah, NAD is a small molecule that's been around since the first life forms. And it's used to carry out chemical reactions in the body, about 400 to 500 of them. The problem is that we need it, and in 30 seconds without NAD, we're dead. And as we get older, we make less and less, and we chew up more and more of it. And so older people, if you look at their skin, one study showed there are half the levels of NAD that those people would have had when they were 20, which is probably a bad thing for the sirtuins to be able to work actively, because the sirtuins actually need NAD to carry out their protection. Sirtuins you can think of as traffic cops in the cell that tell other proteins to go out and fix things. And that doesn't work unless you have a lot of NAD around. And so there are what are called NAD boosters. These are also called NAD precursors or supplements. And you can find them on the internet. There's a big war raging between which is better, precursor NR, which is nicotinamide riboside, NMN, which is nicotinamide mononucleotide. Just to give you the biochemistry, NR gets turned into NMN, which gets turned into NAD. Okay, so they're all in the same pathway. My view on this is that nobody really knows, and there's a lot of vested interests in making their product sound more important than others. I've studied mostly NMN, and I know in human clinical trials that it raises NAD very effectively. And so while people can debate which is better or whether NMN gets in through this way or that way into the cell, it really doesn't matter. I can tell you for a fact that in the last 2 years of clinical trials in dozens of people, if not hundreds, that this stuff works to raise NAD. The question is, does it treat a disease? Does it slow down aging? Does it improve vitality? And there are some hints in the literature that that happens. There was a science paper from Shin Imai and others at WashU who showed that it improves insulin sensitivity in people. But what we really don't know is if it's going to be a longevity molecule. I would say that it's very safe. There's been no sign of toxicity from anything that I've scene. I don't buy the data yet that says that it could be dangerous at this point, but we are continuing to do the safety studies, as well as studies that look at changes in muscle strength, muscle metabolism, and even mitochondrial diseases. There's one called Friedreich's ataxia, and that study is ongoing down at in Philadelphia. So that's it. I mean, would I recommend buying NMN or NR? Well, I don't ever use the word recommend. I'm not a doctor, and it's not of me to say. But I've been taking NMN for at least 5 years. And I started taking it when my inner age from Inside Tracker said that I was 58, and I was 48 at the time. And I thought, this is a really bad look. And if I die early, it would just look bad. So I started taking NMN, and I lost some weight. I started taking metformin, continued to lose weight. I lost about 8 to 10 pounds. And my inner age went from 58 to 31.4, which was a great result. And I've kept it low. Actually, my age has been steadily getting younger over the last decade, according to Inside Tracker.
Awesome. I would say NR and NMN supplements are probably one of the biggest questions that we get on, do we recommend these at the moment? So thank you for not recommending, but providing some context.
Oh, actually, I'll say one more thing that I get asked all the time. What do should people look for? Well, it's GMP, which is a certain grade of material, GMP. You want to look for reputable suppliers. And the material should be light gray or white. Otherwise, it's gone bad. So those are the three main things to look for. NMN tastes to me a bit like burnt popcorn, so you'll know you've got the right product. The scary thing is that sometimes NMN isn't even in the product. So I would taste it. And if it tastes a little bit sour, salty, that's probably NMN in that. What I'm trying to work on, and I'll reveal this for the first time here, is a system that allows people to make judgments about the quality, reliability, and the science of supplements. But that'll come out later.
Awesome. Very exciting. My mom would love the burnt popcorn taste of that supplement. And I should just say that we have not changed the inner age algorithm to keep you at your age. That is really working to keep you there. Can you talk through the relationship between stem cells and longevity?
Sure. So we need stem cells. They're producing new cells all the time. We know a lot about it in the skin. When you lose stem cells, your hair goes gray, you lose hair production, your skin starts to wrinkle, you get thinning of the skin. Another example would be, let's see, what's a good one? So stem cell therapies are replacing parts of joints and whatever, because you lose the ability to fix the joints if you wear them out. The problem with stem cells replacement, though, is it's often hard to get them to go where they belong, especially in complex tissues like the eye. But they're very important. Without them, you know, we're not going to survive for very long. But what we're working on in my lab is to try and reverse the age of those stem cells so that they don't die and that you don't need to replace them. And we had this paper in Nature in December showing that we could rejuvenate cells, and we're now looking at rejuvenating all the cells in the body, not just the eye cells. But until then, I think stem cells are really important. The other thing that the audience may not know is that you can take a skin cell from a person and make that a stem cell now and grow new tissues, new skin, even small mini organs that one day can replace the ones you have. In my lab, we're making mini brains and studying them for Alzheimer's disease and reversal of aging in those. So they're
wow.
Yeah, what we don't know, though, is how important is it? If you just reverse the age of stem cells and stem cells alone, is that sufficient? I'm sure it's necessary, but is it sufficient? I don't think we know that yet.
And stem cells are like kind of the starter type of cell that can become specialized into or differentiated into a lot of other things, correct?
That's right.
In case there wasn't a knowledge out there of what those were. So you could take a stem cell, take it back to, or a skin cell, take it back to nothing, and then turn it into something else, basically, which is pretty cool. I shouldn't say nothing. All right, let's see. So also, you had a recent breakthrough paper, Reprogramming to Recover Youthful Epigenetic Information and Restore Vision, that you just mentioned was published in Nature last year on the eye. Can you explain what you think some of those implications are from your recent breakthrough?
Well, one is that we think that epigenetic changes, these are the control systems that decide for the cell which genes to turn on and off. This epigenetic information we think is lost over time, and that's a primary cause of aging. And we've shown that for 10 years now. We have a paper that we're trying to publish now that shows if we disrupt the epigenome and how the genes are regulated, we actually accelerate the age of a mouse. It looks old, it is old. We can measure that aging. This is important. We can measure the age of cells by looking at the pattern of chemicals that are called methyls that are stuck onto the DNA. And they are set down when we're young, but they change. Some of them change as we get older in a way that's predictable, and it correlates with lifespan and health. Steve Horvath has put his name on that clock. Now, we can show that that mouse accelerates in age. We measure its Horvath clock. But now we could ask the question, can we reverse it? And we spent about 5 years looking for genes from that are normally found only turned on in embryos, such as what are called the Yamanaka factors, the factors that can actually take that skin cell from an adult and make it nothing, pluripotent. And we put three of those in and had a breakthrough. We tried many genes, but the three that worked were three Yamanaka factors, and we could take the age of cells back in the dish, but we also could use gene therapy and deliver those three genes with a virus into old mice and cure their blindness that comes from glaucoma, from nerve injury, and also from old age. And so that was the first example that you can reverse the age of an old tissue completely without any negative side effects.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. So David, the next question is about our future. And what do you think about someone that is around my age, 50, and with all the advance that you have and other, like Steve Horvath and other, what will be the expected lifespan that we will live? Can you give us a guess, or is it too hard?
It's not too hard. It's just too risky.
Okay.
I like to be controversial to get people to think. And I've said that it's possible that the first person to live to 150 has already been born. But for those of us who were born in the 20th century, I think it's reasonable to expect that we could make it to 100 or more. If you just know the fact that if you do the right things that we all know, don't smoke, eat less, or certainly don't become obese, do some exercise, eat less often, eat the right foods and get sleep and don't stress, have some friends around. That gives you 14 years of extra life compared to someone who doesn't do those things. If you add on the things we now know, which is how to intermittent fast, some supplements that may work, some exercise programs that are optimal, and future discoveries, of course, we've got another 20, 30 years to go that these can really help, including age reversal, then I think we could easily make it to 100. Can we make it to 120 and beyond? I'm much more optimistic now than I was even 5 years ago, given A, that you can reverse the age of a tissue, and B, the amount of interest that's piling on into the aging field, including investment in biotechnology companies that will develop medicines that I'm certain we'll see in our lifetime.
Very cool.
Awesome. Very exciting. All right, so when we started, you mentioned that you're not just kind of interested in publishing papers, but also in making a difference in actual human health span or lifespan. What changes do you think need to happen on the society level? Could be government, innovation, things in our healthcare system, our food system, anything like that, that would be necessary to increase lifespan to the greatest possible age we could all live.
Right. Well, the easy things are skip a meal each day, two if you can. Move. I think a lot of people who do inside track are very healthy already. So I'm preaching to the choir here. But yes, get off your chair, run 10 minutes a few times a week, lift weights or do yoga. Try meditation, try to sleep well. Don't overeat and eat the right foods. The right foods for total longevity are mostly bent towards vegetables, but meat's not going to kill you. You know, I'm not one of these strict vegetarians in my own life either. So all of that is the start. That's easy. But unfortunately, the government's been telling us that for probably the last 30 years, and it hasn't penetrated the entire population. There are alternatives. There are drugs that are on the market that are thought to extend lifespan and slow down aging. One of them that I think is the most promising is metformin, a drug that's given to type 2 diabetics that have high blood sugar. And it's a relatively safe drug. It's on the list of the World Health Organization's essential medicines for humanity. It's actually just bought like candy in other countries besides the US. It's over the counter. But here in the US, you need a prescription. So the government, if they could fund at least a study to test, maybe not show, but test that metformin can slow down diseases, it would be great. Right now, we have a lot of circumstantial evidence from papers published that have looked at over 40,000 type 2 diabetics. And they, on average, live longer than non-diabetics. They have less cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, frailty. So it looks really good. And for just a few cents a day, which would be one of these pills, I calculated with my colleagues and published just yesterday in the journal Nature Aging that in the US alone, in the long run, you could save about $86 trillion. And that's conservative. That just says that we could live an extra 2.6 years. If we could go 10 years, we're talking about $300 or more trillion savings to the US economy in the long run.
So, David, can you discuss your campaign to make aging as a disease? Because I think that that's somehow connected to what you are discussing about metformin.
Yeah, well, it'd be great if the FDA would declare aging at least a medical condition, because then doctors would feel comfortable prescribing medicines that would help, like metformin, we believe, or at least talk about aging. You know, very few doctors do that. Their attitude is, oh, it's a natural process. Nothing we can do about it. Deal with it. You're supposed to get sick as you get older. That's just how things are. But that's how doctors used to talk to patients who had cancer 100 years ago when they had nothing much they could do. I think that aging should be a medical condition. It's just a very common one. It certainly fits the definition of a medical condition. It causes pain, suffering, and death. That's what it is. The only difference is that aging affects more than half the population, whereas diseases affect less than half the population. And that is a totally arbitrary cutoff. And it would really help in other ways if aging was a medical condition, because it would inspire students, it would encourage investors, and I think that we'd make a lot more progress. And just by addressing one disease at a time, it doesn't greatly extend lifespan. In fact, it barely improves health span. If you look at the propensity now of Alzheimer's disease, that's largely because we've helped the heart, but we don't slow down aging in the brain. So we need to tackle all the organs at once. And by addressing the root causes of aging, really that's the only way to do it.
Cool. So can you discuss a bit, what are you cooking in your lab right now? What are you working on, if you can? And what are you expecting to see in the next, decade or so out of your lab?
Yeah, I hardly know what we're going to discover next week. And I definitely didn't foresee this future 10 years ago. I mean, I generally did, but it's much more exciting than I could have predicted. I am opening up my lab. We are going to be a social media lab soon, which I think will be great, because we do need to inspire students, young teenagers, especially those from backgrounds that don't even consider science as a career. Now, so I'll be talking about this, but just as a preview, what we are doing in my lab is, so we've got this ability to dial up aging in the forwards and reverse direction. We've got the ability to reprogram tissues to make them younger. We're looking at recovering memory and the ability to learn in old mice. So far, that's looking promising by changing the age of the brain. We're looking at skin, a spinal cord injury. We have other projects. We are looking at ways to protect the genome from damage and epigenetic changes. We have a protein that comes from very stress-resistant and radiation-resistant bacteria. That one's coming to fruition. We've looked at resveratrol in more detail than probably anyone cares to. It was controversial because Pfizer basically attacked my science for whatever reason you can probably guess. But you know that they said resveratrol doesn't act on SIRT1, the enzyme, nor do the drugs we were developing. Well, you know, they essentially screwed up that entire field of medicine, unfortunately. We're trying to revive it, but what they didn't do was to crush the science, and we prevailed, showing that resveratrol does activate SIRT1. And the new study is we made a mouse that doesn't get activated by resveratrol just by changing one amino acid in the enzyme. And we could test whether resveratrol has a benefit on those mice. And the answer is it doesn't. It's blocked by this SIRT1 activation mutant, which to me really finally nails it. But I'll use this as a platform to tell you and your audience that once something, some idea gets out in the media, it's really hard to reverse it. And I still meet people who say, oh yeah, all that stuff from your lab was BS, when, you know, since 2013, it's been proven to be right in science and Nature papers by us and others. But we'll continue moving on. There's nothing much you can do about public perception, except do your best and do good research.
David, a follow-up question about that, because I think that a lot of our audience doesn't understand how hard it is to be a scientist, as you said. You published something 8 years ago and still someone attack you. That's not fair. But also, how hard is it to be a graduate student and an undergrad and a postdoc? So can you describe a bit who are the people in your lab? What is the mix of undergrad, graduate, postdoc, and where are they from? And whatever you can share, that will be amazing.
All right. Well, from all over the world, I'm lucky that I get the pick of the best people. We're very motivated. There are three or four graduate students, and some of them are still with me. So it's sometimes hard to discern. But yeah, often they stay on for another year or two afterwards to finish stuff up. And then we have the rest of postdocs and a couple of technicians. And we have a lot of bioinformaticians that work with us from the outside. They don't have to come into lab. That's mainly it. It's about 1,500 square feet, and you know, it's pretty crowded in there. But we like to ask big questions. In my lab, what it's like is if you come up with an experiment, you have to justify why it's important for the world and why would anyone care. And we don't work the way a lot of labs do. Most labs say, well, we have this animal or this worm, and we have this technique of knocking those genes out. Let's just knock genes out in the worm. We don't do that. We sit back and we say, what are the big unsolved questions of humanity? And then we figure out how to solve that with new technologies and new models, which is really hard. In my lab, you've got to be brave because it's risky and you've just got to think on your feet. And often our papers have a lot of authors because we have to have expertise in pathology and machine learning. We've built our own computers. It takes a lot. And I don't profess to know everything. So you have to be the world's expert in my lab at what you do. But what's it like being a scientist? Well, it's thrilling to do something that is at the forefront of human knowledge. When I was a graduate student, it was the best time of my life. It is stressful. It's a lot of work. You do have to work on weekends typically. And it can be stressful when your projects fail or experiments fail. But no one in my lab has ever failed in the long run. And what you need to do is select a supervisor that ensures that you take calculated risks. So you could have a risky project, but also a middle one and a really safe one just in case. So it is hard being a scientist, especially at our level where you've got to bring in millions of dollars, you've got to fight politics, you've got to deal with the journals, you're on the public face, and you're in a department that is filled with people smarter than you. All that's stressful. And you're always worried about running out of money. That never goes away. But what I tell people in my lab is it beats working for a living because it's super fun and you make your own hours and you can travel. And as a professor, you know, I could jump on a plane to go to London tomorrow if I wanted to. In a regular job, you have to take time off, ask for permission, and do what you're told. I'm not good in jobs. I cannot be told what to do. So that's another reason I have to be a scientist.
Me neither.
Gil has some of the FU gene as well.
Yeah, all entrepreneurs need that.
Gil, any other questions?
No, I think, David, it was an amazing interview. And I think that it's great to hear what's happening under the hood of a very successful scientist. And I know, I've been there, that it's not all rosy and there are a lot of failure. And I remember, I can tell a story. I got a fellowship from Estee Lauder once. And after a few years, when I left Lenny's lab, the person from Estee Lauder came to me and asked her, okay, how have I done? And she told me, you've done amazing, but the only thing that you could improve is you should communicate to me the failure that you had. I know I'm a scientist, so I know that 98% of the time you fail. And I failed to do that and tell her that I failed a lot. And I just showed her the positive. So I think that something that we as a scientist need to communicate to the world, yeah, it's fun and you can fly to London, all of that, but you have a lot of stress. And 98, maybe David is more successful, so it's not 98. For me, it was 98. But still, 90% of the time you fail, and you need to wake up in the morning and say, okay, this direction didn't work, I will go to the left or to the right. And you need to be very creative and hardworking. And you can see that someone like David done it and done it amazingly, and he continued to do it.
Well, Gil, we were teasing Gil before as he was texting you before we started recording. What would it be like if we could text David Sinclair whenever we wanted to? And all of the random questions we would send to you. If someone somehow got your phone number and asked you to tell them one thing that you do every day to impact your longevity, what would you say to them before you deleted their number and blocked them?
I would. In fact, texting is a very good way to communicate with me. If you work with me, that is, my lab can text me, and they do all the time. One thing I would say that's changed my life a lot is to eat less often. And I've gotten my 20-year-old body back. I feel great. I sleep well. I've always skipped breakfast as best I could. I'm not a morning breakfast guy. But if you need breakfast, I would say try to skip dinner or just have a really small one, because that period of your body not having food to process is, I believe, extraordinarily beneficial. And it's not that hard. But I wouldn't start with skipping two meals a day and all snacks. It's too hard to do that. But work your way up to it. I know this is a long text, but it's a good question. I drink a lot of coffee and tea and then hot water and then just cold water. I fill myself up with liquids, and that's the best way to get rid of that feeling to go eat. But also, if you're anything like me, 80% of eating is just because you're bored or you want to do something. You don't actually need to eat. And so there's also this mindset you do need that ability to say, I know, brain, you want me to go do that, but I'm not going to do it. And that takes some willpower. It's not simple. But actually, once you get to my stage, and it takes about 3 weeks, it feels weird to eat that much. And you'll certainly look and feel better because of it.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you so much for joining us today. That was really great to get to meet you in person and to learn from you.
Thanks for listening to Longevity by Design. Please subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Longevity by Design is powered by Inside Tracker, a personalized health optimization platform that helps people improve their lives by improving their bodies from the inside out using personalized, science-backed recommendations for nutrition, supplements, and lifestyle changes. To learn more, visit InsideTracker.com/podcasts.